Bé, doncs ara la segona sessió que està prevista per ara, que tindrem sempre el mateix esquema, una hora al voltant d'una hora de cada conferència, i després, com hem fet abans, deixant temps per les preguntes, doncs la segona sessió la dedicarà el professor Sant a parlar-nos sobre l'experiència del Museu Britànic als anys 90.
Ok. So, I'm talking about the British Museum 1999-2000 or some years earlier also, because it's a very, very telling story. I mean, it's the conflict that we were talking about can be found here. It's not just, you know, a small village in Italy lost somewhere. This is the British Museum, center of London, one of the best institutions inside London. And it has been very controversial for years and years. So, basically, in 1996, the Board of Trustees was asking for a management report on the British Museum. In their view, that was to certify, to show how the British Museum was in desperate need for money. So that was just giving this kind of consultancy to have some sort of support for asking additional money. That was 1996. Unfortunately, the report itself, that was run by Edwards, Sir Edwards, it was a tax officer and a group of consultants, came out being a very, very critical report on the management of the British Museum. Differently from what would happen in Italy, and I guess in Spain, if I understand Spain like Italy, the report was published by the British Museum, despite it was very critical. That's some kind of fairness that the Anglo-Saxon do have that we don't. And that was a very the start of the very interesting controversy and debate on the British Museum. So basically, what I'm trying to focus here is on this very critical report on management of the British Museum. Try to tell you a bit what was found by the consultants. Something that you will find in many other places. But then I would try to deconstruct this report in different ways. First, as a management scholar, if I were, in a sense, if that report was sent to me as a sort of articles to be published in a management journal, as a critique from a management point of view, what is weak, what is misleading in this report? And second, I would, in this paper, was looking at the debate on the press, how curators are humanists in general, or people in the world of culture were reacting to this report and the proposal by the Edwards report. And then a third way of looking at critical assessment of this report is looking at things are 10 years after, what really changed. Okay, this is a paper I was publishing in 2000. Last couple of weeks ago, I finally was able to meet Neil McGregor in Rome, and we agreed to have a sort of second go, updating the case study, see, 10 years after. By the way, if you go on the website of the British Museum, you will find 10 years of financial statement and 10 years the PDF file of the memo of the Board of Trustees. There is a tradition of, you know, information disclosure that we in the Latin area of the world should learn from. I mean, if you go in Pompeii, you won't find anything. I don't know about Catalan museums and institutions, but this is something really we should learn. So let's go to the, when I start, I love doing research. I mean, I love doing kind of dirty research, not the ivory tower of desk research of most of my management colleagues. So I usually do research when I read something on the newspaper. And this was the possibility to have a strike at the British Museum 33 January 2000. And for the first time, staff and workers were united. It was threatening to strike for the first time in the at that time, 246 year old institution. That was the first strike. And that's interesting. That's something. So that I decided to go and have a look. The story can be traced back to 96. It was the publication of the Edward Report. In 97, a finance director, the first finance director ever in the British Museum, were hired. In 1999, the managing director was hired. In November 1999, there was the decision to make 90 job redundant, and so that white people were going on strike. So I tried to disentangle this story. So, okay, this is, you know, journalists are good at doing their jobs, but usually they have no time, so they don't understand that much. Make things so much simpler than they are. Let's go back, the sort of flashback to the British, and this is the sources I was looking. This is the Edward Report. These are some documents, internal documents of the British Museum, of the unions, of the correspondence, and these are press articles also. Once again, from a methodological point of view, management is not there in itself. Management is how you talk about managing. So it's a discourse about managing. And once again, it's not I tell you what to do. I'm trying to understand what discussion, what the things are under discussion, what the controversy are, how priorities, issues, and things are addressed. When I talk about the great court scheme, this is the British Museum now. You know, this here was the, inside was the British Library that we're going to move in these years. It was a decision to move at the King's Cross. And so the British Museum were given this new asset, this old asset, which is the library itself. Here, there was a lot of, you know, inner buildings that were destroyed in a very long, difficult construction process. So from a functional point of view, the British Museum is not anymore as it was before, as, you know, miles of, you know, to go from a gallery to another, in the past you have to go from a linear point of view. There was no way to get access to a sort of hub. That you, now you can go outside, you can move freely from different collection where you're interested. And this is also, is a sort of, you know, entertainment area with bookshops, coffee, you know, smelling as, you know, being in the UK, you have this kind of bad smelling of UK sandwiches, and that will be different here, I guess. So, but and this is the roof by Foster, beautiful. And this took 5 years for an enormous amount of energy, enormous amount of money. But that was a very important project of transformation. So this, I have a sort of hate and love relationship with Edward's Report. I hate it and I love it. And when I'm using it with my students, I give them, one of the best thing in my paper is that I was scanning and then attaching on the paper the executive summary. So you get an executive summary of first class consultancy report, which is nice, I think it's very useful. And I give them to read, and then we start the discussion, and I say, for the first 45 minutes, no rights of criticism. You have to find nice things, interesting things in this page, in this executive summary. A lot of things that we don't like, of course, but that's the second, no. For the first 45 minutes, please focus on that. And first, what I like is this kind of content table, which is some sort of, at least in principle, as a willing, it's a sort of holistic kind of view of the museum. They are not looking at just visitors, they are not just looking at something. At least the intention seems to be looking at different things, starting from corporate identity, legal status, management culture and structure, management main programs, financial management, staff, paid personnel, development and infrastructure, and so on. Expenditure department, income, budgeting. I mean, it's a good way of, if you have to do a dissertation or a thesis as a student or a researcher as a professional, it's a good way of summing up things. Yeah. So basically, I'm passing very quickly the content, and I can send you the appendix itself. There is a starting point, which is they were expecting a severe cut in financial resources for the incoming years. First, there was a 15% of reduction expected in real term, given the inflation rate. So in 5 years' time, they were going to lose 15% for that. And also, because the British Library moved out, and the government made the British Library moved out, the British Museum was losing the rent from the British Library for another 10%, which means in 5 years you will lose 25% of your budget. That's a serious issue. That's why they were asking for this report to sustain the request to get more money from the government. This is really another era. It's the beginning of the other era. And a team was set up, a team with very different consultancy firm, both from a professional point of view, on the, you know, collections, on restoration, etc., etc., and some important management consulting firms, McKinsey, which is perhaps the worldwide the most important strategic management consulting firm, Ernst & Young. That is one of the auditing and accounting firms that are also trying to do some consultancy. Okay, and that was the chapters. They're trying to pass very quickly some of the content. In terms of management, culture, and structure, they were criticizing the kind of conservatism of this organization. They were suggesting a new organizational structure. They were suggesting very radically outsourcing everywhere. Outsourcing, outsourcing, outsourcing. They were suggesting some policy redefinition, reduction of numbers of exhibition per year, and a lot of other kind of tools, using written strategy, using a food costing approach, sponsorship, and so on, to slow down gallery refurbishment, kind of refurbish all the galleries with this rhythm, you slow down. And it was suggesting, however, to increase the acquisitions, to devote part of the budget for increasing acquisitions. They were suggesting the introduction of high caliber, whatever that means, planning process and annual report. And then that was nothing compared to what they were really suggesting, stuffing. Cut of 20% of the staff. That's 1996. And then reviewing the pay structure, and so on. And finally, we have a budget assumptions, two budget assumptions. Option A, without charging for ticket. We'll come back on hidden deficit. The option is to reduce one third of the employees, and still you have deficit. So you have this second option, which is charging for admission, with the staff reduction only 20%, only 20%. And within 3 years, you could be recovered, get to the break even. Okay? This is the summary of the this. Now, how is this is the content more or less. Let me tell you, I mean, any report usually in the Anglo-Saxon world is due as the first part, which is an executive summary, and then the report itself. Assuming that managers or executives do not have time to read, or maybe they don't, they are not able to read sometimes. So they just give some pictures in the beginning. So it's 3, 4, 5 very heavy pages summing up everything, basically. It's 111 points, you know, any paragraph is numbered. That's the US, the UK, the British people used to do. And you have this list of points, 111 points on different elements. And I remember when I was, there was the fundraiser that gave me this document, and I read it, and the first reaction, wow, that's really critical, radical criticism to the British Museum way of managing. And then I put it on the table, ready for the next 6 weeks, 6 months to be able to find time to, as usual, to work on the paper. Then I get at the right time, then I start reading, and start again from the first page, as we do in the West. Now, and you read on the first page, I was making notes on any point of the Edo reports, and then I was reading the report more extensive. And then, this is my first element of criticism. As a management scholar, how do I see this report? What is consistent with managerial rhetoric, with managerial ways of doing research in the management field? And there are three kind of criticism, in my view. I forgot to tell one other, sorry, before going ahead. There's one of the other things that I found interesting in this report. I mean, there are a lot of individual aspects that really telling about the situation. There is a notion that I found in the British Museum, which is crucial in my view, which is the notion of hidden deficit. What is the notion of hidden deficit? It's, we are out of the market. We are not in a competitive market as public sector and public institution of this kind. So you really can make the level of service decrease more than in any other competitive market. So for instance, you don't have, in Pompeii at the same time, there was two computers, 1998. No signs and so on. So in reality, you can save a lot of money. You can save more than what is normal according to professional standards. So if you look at the financial statement and the income statement, there is a deficit, but there is a hidden deficit for the amount of resources that you don't spend to provide normal level services. And I think this notion of a hidden deficit is so strong in public sector, at least in Italy. I mean, when you have you don't find the paper in the toilet in our university, you don't find the paper in the printers. I mean, so if you look at our financial statement, there is something that you don't see is the deficit that we should have had, because we should have bought paper for toilets and printer in a different way if possible, okay? So I love this notion of hidden deficit, and I was going, in the following years, I think I made the use of this notion in important ways. And it's a notion that never appears anymore in the literature, but I think it's a very good notion. You can make the level of surface decrease, and then you, in a sense, you don't have costs that you should have had. So. Apart from this beautiful notion, there are three kind of criticism as a management scholar. First is how big, generic, superficial management report of this kind is to some important extent. The second is internal inconsistency. The third, the lack of standard of managerial research. So let me try to go ahead and see one by one. when looking at this report and then entering in detail and trying to understand in detail, was a lot of the 111 points that were made that was basically addressing procedural things more than substantive things. And when they were talking basically about money and people, telling very little about how to deal with your bloody collection to a director of the museum. So that was really where my model, where my framework emerged. And I love this kind of empty rhetoric. And this is stupid rhetoric. The Museum of Product Management is distinctly conservative, which is really funny because if you think that the word of conservator or conservatori in French and in Italy, I don't know in Spain, but it's really the one that had to conserve. So stay telling to a conservatory, which is conservative. It's my job, you know. It's really with not even understanding professional values and so on. And this is funny. It's less strategic. What do you mean? I've been the first 10 years of my life before doing this kind of research. I spent 10 years of my life working on the notion of strategy. What do we mean by strategy? I could survive 10 years of writing out beautiful papers. What do you mean by strategy? We can, really, if we had time, we can make a joke and write on a piece of paper, what do you mean by strategy? And then each of us has different perceptions. It's a weak, ambiguous, I love because it's ambiguous term. Less enthusiastic about professional skills, technology, modern management. Less willing to grasp nettles, less outward-looking, it's nice. That one may expect. There's been too little clarity about purpose and direction, how decision will be taken, when and by whom. This is talking about mission, it's not using the term mission here, but they were using the mission. That's the last time I used the term mission. After the paper, I was unable to use the term mission anymore. The other one is even more rhetorical, empty rhetoric. The museum should adopt a new approach to external relations. I learned, never use a new approach. Never trust anyone who's talking about new approach. If I know what I mean, I'll tell you. So if I'm not saying anything more particular, I mean, we always use this kind of temporary category. The new and the old, come on. Be a man, what do you mean by new, what do you mean by old? I really learn, and I'm teaching my students, never use it. If you're writing, if you discover yourself writing new and old, that means that you don't know what hell are you thinking. And if you, that's for you, of course, that's also for others. Based on friendly, informal, open and frequent relations with outside constituents, including government, from someone coming from, as me, from Italy, and you know, the kind of connections and mafia relationship, listening, an Anglo-Saxon calling for this kind of word is a bit suspicious. A new approach is, what do you mean, is needed to pay personnel and IT management. In all cases, it is radical, strong, it's Nazis. I mean, in all cases, strategies, projects, project briefs, and responsibility should be clearly defined. There's a book that's mainstream in management in 1980s, in the 80s, The Passion for Chaos. This is Peters and Waterman after the book on In Search of Excellence. This is not a radical socialist or Marxist management scholar. There are some of them in the US, paradoxically, or in the UK. This is mainstream management saying chaos is not that bad. So this is very old, even compared to mainstream management. For both public and internal purpose, the museum need to formulate and project a new statement of purpose, core objectives, and key internal objectives, the bloody mission. This needs to indicate what and whom the museum is for, what the priorities are, and what sort of institution it wishes to be. That's an anthropomorphic view, as if the museum is a person. He wants to be, he wishes to be, come on. It's a bloody organization. Organizations that have selves, mind, are people which have their own strategies. So, but then, and then really that was my model, really, my framework really explored by, thanks to Excel. And I was plotting the 111 statements and trying to see, this one is referring to what kind of things? Blah, 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 blah. And then my categories that are presented in an objective way before we merge. And when I put on the, and I was plotting different statements in this framework, that is the result. Basically, most of it is on resource and personal, financial resource and human resources. It's saying very little, if nothing, about collection. But even interesting for myself, I was surprised when I saw this table, it's not even telling anything about marketing, about commercialization, about, you know, that's something that, you know, when you perceive this kind of, that's a sort of attack by management rhetoric. It's an attack on that specific way, particular part of management rhetoric. He's not even asking for commercialization of Disneyland kind of approach. It's not even that. And he's talking mostly on procedures than on content. So there is a procedural bias. Looking at visitors, looking at collections, looking at human resources and financial resources, in reality, it's much more expensive. The consultant do not have time. They were working for free, by the way, that really another part of the story. Little attention to substantive issues, nothing about collection in substantive terms, but also unexpected lack of focus on demand side. So, if you remember I was reading before that it's inward looking, the museum should be outward looking. It is the report, actually, which is really some kind of inward looking. It's not even addressing the issue of visitors to the new extent. Not even a marketing focus. So it's vague and it's biased from this part. So my second point is the internal consistency. And this is really something interesting because I was reading the first time the executive summary, then the second time the executive summary, slowed down, taking notes, word by word, a sort of content analysis. And then I passed to chapter one. Chapter one was really description of the team, blah, blah, blah. And the second chapter, I suddenly come up and say, well, what's there? It's a sort of celebration of the British Museum. Something, the mood, the tone was totally missing from the executive summary. It's a jewel in the crown of the kingdom. It's an asset, it's really a chapter which is close to celebration. One of the most important institutions in the world, one of the most excellent organization with minor problems. For instance, some missing effort in terms of marketing orientation. But it's really addressing the chapter two, the cultural in and economic value, assets in tourism in London. So there's a feeling in this chapter that was not in the executive summary. So they are saying, beautiful organization, excellence, with minor problems. What you perceive, what I perceive my first and second time looking at the executive summary, a severe criticism and a cost-cut exercise. I'm not questioning whether I'm right or not. There are two parts, there are two ways that were not represented. There is some controversy internal between management expert, and I guess chapter two is written by McKinsey, I bet, I don't know, but I'm sure about that. And the other is dominated by Ernst & Young, accountant, whose job is cutting costs more than opening strategic perspective. But what is really interesting in terms of recommendation, when you read the executive summary, I gave you some example, all strategies should be written, etc., etc. What is written in chapter two is I'm sorry, this is the third point. Okay, we can go to the third point first. Is, okay, excellent organization, it's a bit of a mess. You should make your strategy a bit explicit from time to time. It could help. I'll do it for you. We are box number two. I'm writing you your strategy. It's nice from time to time to have a written strategy so people can read, can understand, can realize where they are. But this is totally something different than saying every single strategy has to be written. If you write things, you kill things. Writing is stopping change when it works. So when you write a strategy, you don't make it possible or you make it very costly the possibility of change. So you don't find in management good textbooks that suggest to write every single strategy. What you find is the McKinsey approach. From time to time, it should be useful. And I do it for you. It's not such an important. It's just trying to, the substance is a good strategy. From a procedural point of view, I'm writing you, okay? It's a totally different way, but you should write every strategy, everything should be the mission statement, etc., etc. There are two very different ways of looking at management. And even in terms of recommendation, chapter two is suggesting ways of improving the level of service, increase opening hours, increase the number of galleries. The rest of the report and the executive summary is suggesting to cut cost, close the number of galleries, close the opening hours, and so on. Isn't it fascinating that in the same report you find two ways, two inconsistent recommendations? It's not just the word view, it's the recommendation itself. And that a guy that's supposed to be the one that wrote the executive summary did not even realize the inconsistency of management. Management is an inconsistent discipline. It's an anarchist, deconstructed mess of points of view. That's why I love management as a discipline, because it's such a mess. If you know it and you manage it, if you manage management, it can help you. Otherwise, it can really kill you. So that is interesting. I was really when I came to the, I was really, it was so fascinating writing this paper, because it's really, I mean, it's not, I mean, you know, you can say public sector Italy, Pompeii, such a mess, Latin people, they're not Latin. I mean, they're UK serious people, best worldwide consultancy firm, yet they are so inconsistent. If you take a management, marketing, or management accounting consultant in any situation, be sure you will have a completely different solution. Be careful. Who you take will really have an impact on your on what he says, what he understands, what he addresses, and what he will suggest. Isn't it fascinating? It is fascinating. You know, with the idea of management as a strong discipline and that's what to do. I think that is interesting for you as people working in the heritage side. I think that could be, and I was using it even for people that has nothing to do with heritage, because that's really the weakness of management in itself. Oh, standard in management research, what I mean with that, if I were a reviewer of a journal and a paper with such statements come, what shall I do? For instance, even the chapter two, the McKinsey chapter, was questioning the museum identity, saying a bit conservative. I like it. What I buy when I see the British Museum is the feeling of 1900 UK environment. I mean, it is, you know, the smell of history. I mean, we are full of this stupid, no, it's not stupid, all ultra-modern new museums, decontextualized, that can be anywhere, apart from the Bilbao, I'm sorry, against the Bilbao, was the first, and it was there, But how many gallery museums we have all over the world now that looks all the same? How many new museums we have? This is an old-fashioned museum. That's what I love. I think that's what 6 million people loved. So if we love, if we are conservative, that's it. It's a question of market segmentation. If you don't like it, don't go in. And also, but from a methodological point of view, it's interesting. You know, the questioning of the customer, the lack of customer orientation. This is unfair, even in the chapter two. Unfair way of putting things. Either you can say, I am suggesting you to have a customer satisfaction analysis. Or you do it. You don't speak on behalf of the visitors. I think that the visitor do not perceive it as an old institution. Either you suggest to do, from a pure procedural point of view, do a survey, or you do it, there are 6 million visitors there, you ask them and you made the research. But you cannot speak on behalf of the visitor. That's unfair, methodologically speaking. So reject it, or revised and resubmit. That would be my point as a reviewer. Special project, let's do, trying to skip a bit. Overstaffing. I'm not saying it was not overstaffed. I mean, in the same year I was looking at Pompeii, we'll talk about Pompeii later today, it was 700 people. I'm sure that 700 people of that kind could be totally, I mean, probably it's both overstaffing and understaffing, but it is overstaffing of poor position. I'm not saying it's not true. I'm ready. I mean, it's 246 years that this organization never had a sort of systematic managerial checkup. No? So it's not impossible that it's, to some extent, misstaffed, overstaffed, but you have to show it. It's not the rhetoric they were using is weak. I mean, you have to argue. If you want to get rid of people, I mean, you have to show, to prove, to argue that they are overstaffed. It was just saying, according to our expert, come on. How can you say they are overstaffed? Maybe you are right, but you have to be consistent, both from a methodological point of view, I would say also from a moral point of view, if you want to leave 90 families without a salary, I think there are some sort of moral responsibility. I'm not making I'm not saying you should never get rid of people, but it's such a difficult decision politically, not politically, I don't interest, not just about the political aspect, but the moral and professional part of it. So you should be very clear, and you should understand in a stronger way if and why, how these people are redundant. And it was interesting because in the same time when they were suggesting to close some, to get rid of some of the wards in the galleries, they were thinking of closing the guards, the galleries. So if you close the galleries, that means that the people that were taking care of the galleries were not redundant. So once again, it's a sort of inconsistency. I mean, management is such a complex kind of discourse. I mean, it's so easy to write and to write things that no one's really stopped and said, okay, now I'm wasting 2 or 3 weeks of my life reading a 150 pages report. And I'm trying to see word by word how it is connected. And this is really interesting from a rhetoric point of view. In terms of budget assumptions, there is not a mistake. I mean, sometimes it happens. You start on with the wrong step and you misunderstand it. It's like when you're a student. You know, you do your exam, you made a mistake in the beginning, that you're totally consistent. Unfortunately, resubmit again. So the starting point was clear and clearly stated. They were not misunderstanding the crisis. And the crisis is not a crisis related to cost inflation. Is not a crisis related to decrease of efficiency. It's a crisis related to external factors in terms of the decision of the government to reduce to move the British Library, and inflation. So the reasons of the expected crisis were very clearly understood, were never questioned. So that's an interesting point. When you do this kind of research in management and responsibility, in economic responsibility, there is a responsibility on the trustees, on the board of directors, on the director, of course, but there is also responsibility on the above, on the government. I mean, it's not a one-way relationship management, it's a bilateral relationship. It's a trade-off. So what are you going to expect? Are you really cutting one-third of resources? So don't expect that we are going to be open. So it's really a question. They never question the rationale of this choice, cutting 25% of the budget. That was really an obsession with sort of cutting everything, 20%, somewhere a bit more, somewhere a bit less, but this was a kind of exercise. And what I find from a rhetorical point of view, fascinating, the known option A. The option A is a rhetorical stratagem, it's a rhetorical tool to sell the real and the unique alternatives, which is the B. This, you know, and this one thing that is, I haven't mentioned explicitly, the one of the things under debate was to charge or not to charge, you know, and they didn't want, and the British Museum didn't want to charge to visitors, and the consultancy was trying to force them to charge. So the option A is, if you don't charge, you can't make it. The only way is to get it is option B, which means charging, doing that and that and that. So there are a lot of weaknesses in this debate, in this report, even looking, I haven't spent that much time saying what museums director, what museums people, what the community, professional community says. It's just looking at the management report as a management expert. And I remember the comment by the editor of Museum Management Curatorship, where the paper was published, and said, Luca, I never thought that management experts could be critical. He said, come on, we could be a critical management scholar. So it's a, you can deconstruct. And then the other piece of research I was doing, a sort of content analysis of the debate on the press, that was fascinating. So a lot of discussion, we were addressing more or less some of this point. One is the defense of the British identity. And that is really a stronger message on the effectiveness side, on the value of the British Museum, that was much more clear in the press than in the Edwards report. The biggest museum in the world, that's a domestic attraction. I still remember, on memory, more Londoners go to the British Museum than Parisian goes to the Louvre, or so it's a, and it's not for elite. And the report, and then themselves referring to the results in terms of research, loans all over the world, so strong, well-reputed identity, though unfriendly. There's a beautiful paper, I will send you the paper also, by Smith, that was talking about this issue of mission, and they will say, come on, going back in a while on the mission. Other things were talking about efficiency. That's interesting enough. Curators of museum people were addressing a very interesting efficiency issue. The British Museum and the National Library at the time were one of the few museums charging for visitors. They were almost most efficient than the other. If you took in terms of taxpayers, what the cost for the taxpayer per visitor, that is 5.5 pounds per visitor, what the taxpayer have to cover in the two cases of the British Museum and the National Libraries. If you charge ticket, the number of visitors collapse and then get some money, but then it's less efficient from that point of view. And the visitors and the taxpayer has to subsidize more, to pay more for each visitor, which I think is fascinating as an interesting way of being able to engage in this kind of rhetorical exercise. Rhetorical in a good sense, not in a stupid, superficial way. And also the criticism toward the procedural rhetoric that the British Museum as an untrendy entity. And it was this paper by Smith that was criticizing this kind of trendy notion of mission. And it was I love it. It's a very nice paper. You never use the term mission anymore after reading this paper. And so I will send you. And when in the end say blah 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 blah, say, and then so if you really want to force me to look at mission statement, let's go back to the founding fathers and the state of the 1743, the British founders, the fathers were writing down that this was the collection to be open and free to public. So you can't. He asked me to be keen with my mission and then charge it to the visitor, which I think is fascinating in terms, once again, of rhetorical exercise. But it's really, I mean, how people can talk in this silly way, in superficial ways, without understanding identity, history of organizations, and this kind of short secret. So, I love it. To charge or not to charge. It's fascinating. There are three levels of discourse. One is really ideological, and when British people are ideological, they are really hopeless. I mean, the end of enlightenment, come on, it's just a bloody ticket in the end. It's not more than a ticket. I disagree, but over my dead body, the Wilson, that was the previous director, before charging, they should pass over my dead body. Don't say that. They will. So. My suggestion is, do not risk repugnant a cultural tax, come on, or treasures at a time when there has been at a time when there has never been more money spent on us and everything. That's true, but before the crisis. I mean, at that time, it was really one of the peak in the spending of a culture. It was cutting. That's ideological. Don't waste your time on ideology. It won't work. Use your time, your energy to address more, to deal with rhetoric. I would like to run a course on teaching rhetoric to museum director, managerial rhetoric for museum director. That's my ideal course. Let's come to argumentation, questioning economic rationale. I mean, there's a question of elasticity in economics. If you charge prices, the demand will collapse. So it's a question, is that because the visitor has the right, has always right, so if he doesn't want to pay. Short-termism, I mean, you're asking us to go to the sponsor, to find money to refurbish galleries. Then we have to close galleries because we don't have people to work there. The sponsor will get furious, and that was the case on the press. The sponsor that will get furious because spending money for galleries that don't want to look anymore, and so on. And there was also an institutional counter-argumentation that was particularly related with the intrusion of the Labour Party, of the way in which Blair and his team was trying to intrude more than what was the tradition of the arm's length principle. Let me just keep on that. It's too much, but you can find it. But it was really a very interesting debate. And it's funny because on the press, everyone was furious about ticket. Nobody really cares about 25-30% of people working there. That's really some kind of a very aristocratic kind of society in the UK, and that was really no one was really taken, I'm not saying defense in terms of unionized way, I mean, it's not a right, I mean, but just taking the point of view of the, so in a sense, it was a very touching, in a sense, a statement by a paper by a unionist said, come on, that was the mistake by this and this and this, and we are the only one that are going to pay. The 90 cost redundant. It's not because we are losing efficiency, it's not because blah, 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 it's just because you made mistakes. So, yeah, that's so funny to see the little interest in the debate on the, which is interesting, partly from a sociological point of view. I mean, the divided society in the UK is one thing that perhaps you won't find here in Italy at that stage, to that extent. The second is the totally misunderstanding of what a museum is, even by professionals. It's not just a collection of objects. It's not necessarily something for visitor, but it's surely the knowledge that is embedded in people. If you get rid of 25%, unless you're totally inefficient, you're losing knowledge in some sort of irreversible way. You're losing creators, you're losing, so, and nobody really cares about that. So that's something that is interesting too. So, what happened then? Let's try to see the following. Something has been done, something has not been done, and something has been overdone. So, something that have not been done, I mean, they never charge entrance fees. There was not a cost of 25%, but just 15%. I mean, the British Library were reintroduced, the amount of the rent was compensated, and there was not the cost cut of 25%. Yet they survived. So something was a bit too pessimistic, perhaps, in the figures provided by Mr. Sir Edwards. What they've done, according to the report, they hired a new financial director. It's interesting. I mean, the UK is the most, the country in the world with bigger number of accountants, biggest number of accountants. Accountification of society, of UK society, is a book. And they had the first chartered accountant in the museum in 1997. Italy was 1998. So we are late on that. We are terribly late. I'm not saying accountants should run museums, but bloody hell, it's so late, so risky waiting 250 years before having a chartered accountant. Revision of the world contract, there was a lot of discussion about that. You know, this some kind of, that is a part of history. They had some kind of compensation dating 1784. I mean, all this kind of, you know, history is there, and nobody really goes back and see why the salary is this figure. And so they were reviewing from a general point of view, contrast and pay. There was a small redundancy plan for voluntary base. On the voluntary base, 40 people. We were talking about 20%, which would be 200. It was about 1,000 people. So it was just 4% on the voluntary base. There was some redesign in our curatorial departments. There was the compensation for the British Library. They've done a lot of work on IT, very well done, and also in the accounting system, introducing a normal financial report, yearly financial report, which was not there, strange enough. And overdone, they then like the process of hiring people, they start hiring other people, which is marketing and human resource director, which was not addressed by the Edward report. Then a managing director, which was not either. addressed by the Edward report, though on the press they were arguing legitimation was based on the Edward reports, but was really untrue. It was in the kind of very crowdy kind of top management, very unstable in a short period of time. I mean, it's a never-ending story. 2 years later, the finance director gave it up and resigned because there's nothing to do. We are fighting every day with things that I should be doing, and the managing director. So one of us is too much. So he left. And so in the end of the 1999, the crisis emerged, and there was this new situation of conflict there, the starting point of my paper on the strike of a 19 position to get rid of. And that is something interesting in terms of, you know, the unanticipated consequences. And that's something that no one really foreseen. No, there's nothing in the British, in the Edward Report, nothing in the press that is addressing the issue that suddenly emerged at the end of 1999. Okay, bloody hell, the Great Court is going to be finished. When is this finished? We need new staff with a different position, with different skills. So we have to hire 130 people. The only way to deal with it, there's no budget for that. We forget to budget this. We forget running costs. The only way to do it is getting rid of 90 persons. So we are funding the new post, killing, firing old position. And that was something that was simply forgotten by trustees, by Edwards, by the government, in all this debate, and even by the press. And I think that's very interesting in itself. The dual organizational structure did not work. The financial director and the historians did not work, and was a continuous conflict on the press, on the trustee board, and so on. And finally, when the director retired, the trustees decide to get rid of the two posts and just recompose in one. Suzanne Tadern was offering herself to become the one director. And they say, no, we're taking a historian at once. And they hired Neil McGregor. So, conclusion, then we have some minutes for talking. That's really, the British Museum is really something that you, it's such an emblematic example of the difficulties of doing a serious application of managerial discourse in museum. What I think is particularly interesting is the internal contradictions within management. This is what I learned about management in general. Should I stop today to do my research on heritage and go back there? That's what I take with me. I learned a lot about this internal inconsistency of different management approaches, discourse, sub-segment of management. And the efforts of politics with this intrusion in current operations and the impossibility, the difficulties of getting the running cost in the agenda. This is something that as a consultant, I'm reselling. I'm a bit ashamed. I mean, I already understood it. I wrote it. Yes, but if people ask me, and 99% of the time, this is an issue. That, you know, go back to the issue of politics and the relationship between politics. And the politics has a short life cycle. Even if they are successful, they won't be here in 2 years' time or 4 years' time. So who cares about running cost? And all the debates is, yes, this is the budget for the restoration, the budget for resetting, refurbishing, or whatever it is, and then the running cost. Who cares about the running cost? That's so stupid as a mistake. And every organization I found in the last 10 years in the public sector had similar problems. That's my fortune, I mean, my research, and my young student can get their PhD on this and making money with that. But it's crazy, isn't it? It's really crazy, particularly with this hundreds of hours of conversation, of rhetoric on management at every level, that everyone simply forgot to address the issue of running cost. If you take something with you, this today, by meaning, one is the trade-off. The second is running cost. It's so difficult. Why business plan is important? Not because it's a business plan in itself. I don't care, in a sense, to be radical, I don't care at all about the initial cost of resetting up a church, a museum, or a building, whatever. I don't care. If someone is speaking about that, it's because they already found that. Otherwise, it would not be a discussion at all. But the real problem is when you finish, when you're closing the works and you're opening the institution on current base, on day-to-day operation, what you get and what you spend, how can you survive between revenues and costs? This is the most important issue that is so difficult to address, particularly related to the issue we were talking before this morning, in terms of different institutional models in public sector intensive countries. Okay, I think we can stop here. Great.
Bé, li agraïm molt al professor de Lausanne la puntualitat britànica que mereix les conferències. Doncs si us sembla, també deixaríem un temps de 10 minuts, un quart, perquè podeu fer les preguntes que considereu oportunes.
By your reference to anthropomorphism of organizations. And also, I wondered if you see that connected in some way. It seems to me that that's actually getting stronger rather than weaker in how people talk about and think about organizations. That may be because I'm from the US where we have now enshrined organizations as, you know, more than they're no longer legal fictions, they're really people. But what I'm curious about is whether that you think that that anthropomorphism has anything to do with our frequent inability to see unintended consequences of changes, number one, and also if you think it has anything to do with the existence of the sort of constant existence of inner inconsistencies, and then just in terms of sort of teaching and changing things, I wonder if you might speak to how you go about, so in your own teaching, contradicting or getting students to realize this propensity we have to anthropomorphize organizations.
Yeah, thanks. Yes, that's the funny part of the job. I mean, I have a very different set of colleagues. Some of them are very, very intensively use the notion of mission, and we openly disagree, we openly quote each other. And when I was in Carnegie Mellon, there was an inaugural lecture, they were talking about non-profit as mission-driven organizations. Come on, that's rubbish. I mean, that's any organization is driven by values. And there's also a value of profit, by the way. But it's one of them, and even in business, even for profit. The whole literature on mission was emerged in the business field, not in museums or in arts organizations. So that's simply. So what, I'm starting from the last one. First, I'm trying to deconstruct in terms of historical debate. I mean, mission is, stakeholder is a paper in 90, I don't remember, from shareholders to stakeholders. That's a paper in business. It's not a paper in museum. That's simply stakeholder is a notion that emerged in a sort of, you know, business context because of more democratic or more plural kind of word. So that's normal, even in the business. So part of my deconstruction is historical. I think, come on, it's not true. That's why I think management history is important, because we could save a lot of time in saying untrue and stupid things, and that's it. That's part of the expression. There is something, I mean, the unintended, and I explicitly leave this kind of contradiction. It's not me. I'm not telling the truth. I mean, this is a controversy. I don't want to be imposed my view. I will fight against this, what I think is openly stupid way of putting things. But you have my friends from Carnegie Mellon or from profession that use the term, that things that they can have values in using. And I'm trying to do my work as a management scholar, spending a lot of time in decision-making processes and showing you how this is totally inconsistent with example like the British Museums, or more explicitly with the lessons on decision-making, and showing you how this is really simply rubbish in terms of things that are not sellable anymore in the business field. You won't use anymore the term to this extent in the business field, as you don't use the very naive way that everything should be written, should be clear. I mean, chaos is, we understood chaos exists. We understood that there's a value in chaos, which is, you know, as in any evolutionary perspective, it increased the probability of variance and survival in the long run. There is a question of unanticipated, this naive understanding of managing, the illusion that you can manage everything. Come on, there is a nice, interesting part in management, which is not that stupid. There's the old tradition of Norwegian, tradition of management, which is totally different, which is questioning the issue of decision-making, the rational decision-making. There is a model talking about decision-making as garbage can. Decision-making is a garbage can. It's like a garbage can where decision problems are put in an uncoupled way, and from time to time they couple magically. It's not naive or snobbish academic radicalism. It's a way of looking at. So I'm working on decision making and try to address. There is one issue which I think is particularly important. One is there is a question of manipulation. I mean, one other thing I explained to students, why I don't read any mission statement. I'm unable to waste my time in reading mission statement. I'm sorry, apart from the document you gave me yesterday. But normally, I mean, with museums, all the same, the looks the same. People writing this beautiful mission statement from time to time should be in jail. Callisto Tanzi, Parmalat, Enron, have a beautiful mission statement. The question is not telling a difference. Mafia has very interesting code. Criminal organization have very strong codes. They are never so stupid to write it in a mission statement. So when you find 11, let's say dozen, of mission statements by criminal organizations, I will go back and use this term. I mean, there's a question of really false consciousness in saying that. You never say, we don't care, we just want to save our job, who cares about the visitor, who cares about the object. You never, the question of fairness. So it's a killed instrument. It's an empty tool in itself. The second is that things that are not made by themselves. And there is a notion, there is an issue of conflict between people. My program at the University of Bologna, JOCA, is beautiful program. It's not the best program for everyone. I had to fight to teach in English, to have a close number, to have resources. We were fighting, we are different gangs of people inside the University of Bologna, as in any university, as in any organization, fight with each other, or fighting between groups, between teams. But this, you know, in the rhetoric of managers, this is sort of, it's not a scene, it's not a scandal. That is how organization works. So why don't make it explicit? It's so difficult to explain to students when they prepare their beautiful project or business plan. Who is your sponsor? Who is fighting with you, for you, against you? This is normal. And organizations do not have a soul, do not have a decision, do not have a memory in themselves. They're made by people fighting. So this is really normal organizational theory teaching, and you have to address the issue. In your organization, who is against, who is for? Who are the parties, who are the different views? But you have really to address. And also, this is really what I dislike more on the term, because it's really more, not only, you know, the unintended, unanticipated consequences, but it's really reification of willingness, of views, of protests by people. And if you don't address those issues on people, so different people, you're just wasting your time, and it will be very difficult to get your individual design, project, strategy, willingness somewhere else. Between us and the paella, that's a very risky.
Well, yes, I would like to give mine your definition of management, because I like it. Every time you say, I love it, so I would like to give mine. May you say, please? Your definition of management.
Addressing attention.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, it's really, you know, it's really this. It's really, you know, I thought when, you know, I love the expression addressing, putting things on the agenda. You know, it's really the way in which you have done something, your interest, concern. There are billions of things that are potentially of interest. But then what you're going to do today, what you're going to do tomorrow, you know, day-to-day practice, things that you could, that I, you know, it's really, it was funny, yesterday we had a presentation of our PhD archaeologist working with us in Turkey. They were talking about how archaeologists understand the issue of management, and was talking about managerial views of an archaeological mission, in the good sense, mission. It's funny because we're talking about management issues, and people say, we don't have time to management, for management. We simply have to get stuff done. So that is really some sort of, you know, making things management as something. So management is managing. Is doing things, is how you try to do what you wish to do, but it's, there's nothing more in terms of, I mean, then there are some things that you can find recurring in managerial talks, which is try to understand consistency, try to understand alternatives, try to understand resources and so on. But don't ask me to define in short term, particularly before the paella, the management. It's a discourse. I can give you interesting, I mean, the paper on the Venice Arsenal is the best paper I ever read. Not because of me, because it's so interesting. And you find the discussion of a 1586 manager that is talking about how shall we do with this bloody arsenal, with the Ottoman, and with this. This is management. It's the conversation on how to do things.
Thanks.
Now. Paglia.